You're listening to Music for Moving Pictures. I'm your host, Tim Grieving.
I have had a studio head say to me, a VP of music of a studio, I won't mention which name, he said, I would love to hire you, but I can't. Meaning he would not be allowed to.
Jermaine Franco has the sadly rare distinction of being one of only two women with a high-profile movie score this summer. In a crowded sea full of superheroes, resurrected dinosaurs, and even an all-women heist movie, all scored by men, as usual, comes Tag, a comedy based on a true story about a bunch of guy pals who've been playing a nonstop game of the childhood classic, Tag, since their childhood. It's the first R-rated comedy ever scored by a woman, and Franco is only just beginning to break down doors to what's pretty much always been an all-boys club. She grew up on the border of Mexico and Texas, and started smashing stereotypes at an early age by taking up the drums. She became a voracious, versatile student of jazz, funk, rock, classical, and Latin music. A winding journey through teaching, playing all kinds of gigs, and writing for theater took her to Hollywood, where she ended up working for last month's guest, solo composer John Powell, programming, arranging, orchestrating, performing, and more. After 10 years with Powell, Franco took her first big solo flight with the Sundance favorite, Dope, an indie coming-of-age film about a group of African-American teenagers in Inglewood. Then came Coco, the Pixar smash about a Mexican boy who loves music and journeys through the land of the dead, was scored by Michael Giacchino, but Franco took an outsized role as songwriter, arranger, and orchestrator, putting her musical heritage to perfect use and putting a real stamp on the soundtrack.
A feeling so close, you will reach out and touch it. I never knew I could want something so much, but it's true.
Earlier this year, Franco scored the Starz drama series Vida about two Mexican-American sisters, and she recently scored the new Kung Fu Panda attraction at Universal Studios Hollywood, which is appropriate since she worked on that film series scores with John Powell. Tag, directed by Jeff Tomsic and starring John Hamm and Ed Helms, which is the highest profile big studio movie she scored yet, and it promises much more to come. At this year's ASCAP Awards, that's the performing rights organization, the American Society of Composers, Authors, and Publishers, John Powell was given the top honor, the Henry Mancini Award, and, fittingly, Jermaine Franco took the other major prize, the Shirley Walker Award, named for one of the maverick women of film scoring. When I interviewed Powell at his studio a few days later, I asked him about his former assistant.
You know, she was just this incredible, wonderful mixture of a composer, a percussionist as well, for which was just perfect for me, and an organizer, and a friend, and a sort of a support system that proved to be incredibly useful. To the point of what was hard was that she was just too. We had this conversation over the last few years she worked for me, which I kept saying to her, you know, you really need to go out on your own because that's going to be the next step for you. You have to take that step. It wasn't that she was frightened of that. It was just that she had her heart was too invested in making sure I was okay, which is could be the problem for women composers, is that they're looking after too many men who are naturally way more selfish. And so I was trying to encourage her, you know, you've got to become selfish to do this. I mean, every composer, successful composer I know has got this real steely success streak. I'm not saying women don't, thank God they do, but it just probably is one of those things that makes, you know, one composer question whether they should do something or the other one not.
We'll be right back.
What did you think about what John said about his theory that men are just naturally so selfish and that women are often just taking care of men and they're so selfless and supportive of men that that's maybe one of the reasons why women get left behind in these opportunities because they're not as selfish.
Well, some people could say he has a point, but I think what he said was right, that women are caretakers naturally. I mean, not all women, of course, but in general, I think also partly how we exist within society, that we are the caretakers in many situations. We're the, you know, the teachers, the nurses, the mamas. And so I think that he is right. I mean, he's coached me on how to sit in the room, how to have a discussion with a director, how to have a voice, because a woman who doesn't feel that free to do that will stay in the background. I just had a conversation with an amazing pianist. I won't say who it is, who is so talented and still, you know, people, they have these incredible credits, like they have the cred, but they don't believe they have it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think maybe that what he said was true. It's like the women, female composers, it's easier to do that. It's easier to stay in a room and be the assistant because you don't have to deal with the stress. The stress, you know, to get ahead in many careers, not just film music. And in like corporate America, I mean, why aren't there more women who are CEOs of companies and, you know, in all sectors? You have to give up a lot as a woman. You have to lose time away from your family. You have to, you know, you have to go against the norm about what is expected of a woman to be and do. And it's not an easy dance.
Yeah.
I was born in California, but was raised in El Paso, Texas, right on the border of Texas and Mexico and New Mexico. And my family is from northern Mexico.
Okay, so you got that Texican blood.
Mm-hmm.
What did your parents do for a living?
My mother was a housewife and a volunteer, did a lot of social work, helped a lot of people in El Paso and still does. And my father was an engineer.
Were they musical at all?
No.
What was the kind of thing that lit the fuse for, about music for you?
There was a piano in our living room that my sister had started to play and stopped, so I would sort of gravitate to it. And then I started in the public school band, and I saw all the instruments. I didn't really know anything about music other than, you know, hearing it and it's part of the culture. But I saw the drums, and I just said, I'm playing the drums. I'm going to do that. I'm not going to play the violin. I'm not going to play the flute, the traditional, you know, female-oriented instruments. I really wanted to play the drums. And so I was in the school band and multiple ensembles. Back then, there were many periods of music in one day.
What drew you to the drums? You just wanted to make a racket, or had you seen a drummer, or...
No, I think that it was the snare drum. I just thought it was so cool. And so I used to take my drum on a skateboard every day because I rented it, and I would drag it back and forth half a mile to school, and I was just into it. I loved playing in the band. We had a concert band. We had a jazz band. I played in the orchestra. So the more I got into it, the more I played timpani. And then because I could play piano, I played all the mallets. So early on, I was playing all of the, you know, instruments in the percussion section, which I loved.
And you were the only girl in the back row, probably?
There were two of us.
Oh, okay.
But mostly the girls got the mallets. But something just inside of me just was very much, you know, ignited and sparked by the whole process of learning music and playing it. And I had a great teacher who was from North Texas State, which is a big jazz school. And so I played in the El Paso Youth Symphony. There is a famous conductor named Ibrahim Chavez at University of Texas, El Paso. And there's a very good classical program, and I was taking a lot of private lessons and just, you know, making hours of music every day.
What kind of stuff were you listening to? Who were the artists or composers that made the biggest impact on you?
When I was a young girl?
Yeah.
I was listening to things like, I'm not really sure I want to say what
you're
I
safe,
was listening.
You're safe
here. Well, I was certainly listening to a lot of Mexican music, like a lot of jarocho music, mariachi music.
On the radio or live?
At all in Mexico when we would go with our family to eat every Sunday in all the restaurants. And the trios, Trio Romantico, where it's three guys singing harmony. And then I was also listening to jazz. I mean, my favorite group was Steely Dan. I loved Steely Dan. I mean, everybody at our school was playing all that, those kind of groups. And I also, you know, I listened to things like Foreigner and rock and roll. And I listened to Peter Frampton. I mean, just like the typical things that, and, you know, funk bands, Parliament, a lot of funk bands. And so, because it's an army base, so the students in our school were either mostly Black or Mexican. Mm. So we had these really great ensembles. Like our whole drum line was all like African American guys with like two or three, you know, Latinos. And so we used to just jam for hours and hours just playing funk on drums.
Yeah. Were you drawn to orchestral music, classical music, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I always loved Bach. I didn't mention that. I mean, on piano, I used to play a lot of Bach and Bartok. I loved the Bartok pieces. I used that to help me, you know, learn piano and Debussy. And, you know, I played the traditional, you know, piano pieces that people learned growing up. And I liked the two of them. You know, I liked both. I didn't really see, to me, it was just a sea of music.
Yeah.
It wasn't just the different terms. I didn't think that way. It was just, was I playing? Was I making music with my friends? Was I in the ensembles?
In high school, kind of as you're thinking about your future, what was your dream profession? Did you just want to stay in music generally, or did you have a specific goal in mind?
I just wanted to play music every day and concerts. I did a lot of performing, and I loved it.
Were you writing at that time?
I wasn't writing formally. What I was doing was a lot of improvisation on the piano, just hours of just playing. You know, I'd play Carole King, and then I'd improvise over, you know, the changes and, you know, playing vibes and improvising. And so I think that the improvisation was the start of my composition, because then when I went to college, that's when I started writing, because I was in a jazz group, and somebody said, "You play really well. Why aren't you writing? You know, why are you just playing other people's stuff? You should be playing your own stuff." And another student at Bryce said that to me. And I thought, oh, great, I'll give it a try. And also I was taking composition and orchestration and, you know, all the natural conservatory music requirements.
So when do the movies come into the equation?
Later on. I was writing and working with theater groups in Houston. I played in the Houston Chamber Orchestra. I toured as a orchestral musician in Spoleto and the opera and the music festival. And also in Berlin, I played with a youth orchestra. So I was doing all these things as a freelancing musician, and I had my own band that was still writing. And prepping, too, to take auditions with major orchestras as a percussionist. But I loved that thing I felt when I played with my own band and I was playing my music, and it just was very empowering. So I decided I had this love of Latin music, and I'd been studying both classical, Latin, and jazz. And I heard Luis Conte, who is a very amazing percussionist. He's on tour with James Taylor right now. But he's a very amazing percussionist who came from Cuba as a teenager. And I had heard him play at a convention. And I was so excited. I had been touring Mexico, playing with a lot of musicians, and playing with musicians from Cuba, Puerto Rico, and just feeling like I just loved Cuban music. So I came to study with him, and I had teachers who basically said, you either move to New York, which I did study there for a summer, or you move to LA. Those are your choices if you want to be a musician. And I went to New York and studied with someone from the New York Philharmonic. I loved it, but I didn't see myself living there, so I moved here. I really had, you know, very few contacts. I started studying with Luis, and I had multiple jobs. I was teaching music. I was playing at the Los Angeles Theater Center as a music director, playing in churches, playing gigs, you know, started to play TV shows, different things. And while working at the Los Angeles Theater Center with several of the theater directors, I got asked to write my first film. Okay. And when I did that, it was through a program called Hispanic Film Project through Universal. And they would sponsor one filmmaker and give them everything they needed to finish a short. So I wound up being the composer on two shorts, and they would provide the scoring stage. So my first short was on the Fox scoring stage with Armin Steiner.
What was the name of the short?
It was called Tanto Tiempo.
Okay.
And I actually, the guitarist that plays on Coco was the guitarist on my first film.
Nice.
And we had been playing as a trio, an ensemble doing contemporary music from Mexico and a lot of indigenous music. And so that particular film was about Aztec music. So I was able to use a lot of the, you know, resources that I had learned from traveling and then also putting it to film. I loved it. I loved being at Fox scoring stage. I mean, what a great experience. I wasn't in my home on a little laptop writing. I was on this huge stage. I had a lot of support. I had amazing, you know, a mixer that mixed all these fantastic movies, mixing my music. And then after that, I wound up doing PBS American Playhouse, a film called La Carpa, directed by Carlos Avila. And those experiences were very enlightening to me that, oh, I like the way this works. You know, I get to write the music, I get to play it, and I see how it moves people on the screen. Telling stories.
So you hadn't sought that out, but once you experienced it, did it change your life to where that became your goal?
It did change my life. I'm sitting here today. It changed my life because I saw that my role as a musician changed from just a performer to becoming a storyteller through music to, you know, visuals. And so I did have that goal. I got more films. I started doing PBS specials and, you know, smaller television specials, but nothing that was at the level that I'm doing now. But it was just, it was a good beginning, yeah. I think. I didn't ever drop the idea of performing. It just seemed like this came easier. And it took... It didn't take less work, but it allowed me to develop as a musician, and I didn't have to schlep my instruments around as much.
So you did it out of convenience.
Maybe. I don't know.
So as you looked down that road, were you daunted or depressed by the fact that most major films are scored by dudes?
It was intimidating after I found out. Because at the beginning, everything seemed to come so easily. Like, oh, I got this. I'm on the Fox scoring stage. Wow. And then I did the PBS thing. And then I was producing some music for Columbia Pictures, you know, Thunderheart, Raul Perez. You know, things were coming to me. But then there would be moments where there was nothing. And then I would see other people who were just getting ahead so much faster. But I didn't ever feel depressed about it. I just felt that I had to work harder in order to make my path. In present day, it is depressing that only 1.7 women in the past 10 years have scored over 900 films out of, you know, it's a USC study by Dr. Stacey Smith. That is a very, very low percent, given the fact there are so many qualified women composers. So when I think of it in those terms, yes, that's depressing. At the time when I was working, I heard that it was depressing. I saw that it was, but I didn't let it deter me.
Yeah. How did you end up working with John Powell?
I met John Powell through my brother, Michael Petri, who's a international artist and curator. He does a lot. At the time, John was working with my brother in a performance art group when John was in college called a Media Arts Group with another composer named Gavin Greenaway.
Right.
The three of them had a trio, and they did a lot of work in galleries and, you know, museums. And so I heard about John Powell when I was still in college, but I didn't know him. And then when he moved to the States and he was working with Hans Zimmer, I was introduced to him at an event. He was very nice, sat down with me and said, oh, I want to know about your music. And, you know, took the time to mm-hmm. listen to my music, which, you know, he's a busy guy. So that was a very, you know, kind thing he did. And later, I actually moved out of L.A. up by Mammoth and lived in the mountains for a while, took a break from L.A., mm-hmm. came back, and when I came back, my brother encouraged me to call John and just see if I could, you know, hang out and maybe be an intern at his studio. And that's how I started, Italian Job.
And how long did you work for John?
I worked for him for over 10 years.
Wow. And programming, orchestrating, arranging, writing additional music, all that?
Yes, and also towards the end I was producing a lot of overdub sessions for him because, as you know, sometimes these deadlines get crazy and he'd be on, you know, How to Train Your Dragon. I went to London before him to produce orchestral percussion. I would produce the soloists for the Kung Fu Panda 2 and 3. So he gave me more to do as he felt more comfortable with me. And you know, we worked many, many hours. And he was a great inspiration and mentor. And not only that, he's a wonderful human being.
Well, that's basically like you got your doctorate in film scoring by through that experience, maybe times two or something.
Perhaps. I mean, there were a lot of long, long hours. But I didn't mind. I loved it. There was never a dull moment. It was always always interesting, always great projects, you know, always something to do, learning, playing music. And in addition to that, I used to play on some of his scores. I played on How to Train Your Dragon, How to Train Your Dragon 2, Italian Job, Rio 2. So I was enjoying myself. I wasn't feeling like I wasn't getting to have a musical voice. Plus, it was a good job. And he was a great person. I mean, I don't think I had any complaints. It was a gorgeous studio. We were like a family. My own son grew up, you know, I'd take him there. It was a very family-oriented place.
Yeah,
so nice. It was nice for me.
Did you have an eye on, at some point, I want to fly solo and do mm-hmm. my thing?
I did. And he encouraged me to do that. And he would say, are you sure you still want to work for me? So don't you want to go out there and fly? And I go, I think I'm okay.
He's trying to push you out of the nest.
Well, he basically said, you know, you have to find your own way. And so I was doing features on my own independent films. And I would literally get up at 4 in the morning and work for hours and then go to John's by 10 and do that for many years. And then also he would, if I had a project, he would allow me when possible to take off and even gave me a writing room, literally, for this film called Margarita. He's like, take that room, don't even look at the emails and work on it and finish it. And I mean, where do you get that kind of support in a studio? And that's what happened for me. So as I started getting bigger projects, he and I talked about when would be a time for me to leave.
I'm really pleased that she's really breaking out on her own, and she's doing it so well as well. And she's doing it with her natural talents, which I think is the right way of doing it. You know, she's not trying to sound like me or Hans or anybody else like that. She's already sounding like Jermaine, which is, that's the perfect way, I think, you know. And yeah, it means you won't be hired on Batman 7 yet, but you'll be hired on things that you're good at, and then you'll shine, and that shine will help the film or the TV show be a success, and that success will help you shine. So it's important to be good at what you know you're good at, and then become successful, become experienced, and then from that experience you can then stretch out, just as I'm still doing. I, you know, try and stretch a bit on certain projects, and she will. She'll be doing Batman 9 when it's the right time, and I mean, that's what I'd like to see. I'd like to see so many more women composers in the mainstream, not just doing dramas and comedies. I want them to all be doing Marvel films, you know, and it'll be wonderful when they do.
Dope is kind of a big milestone in your
yes.
solo career. What were the exciting, interesting musical opportunities that film gave you?
Well, it gave me a new palette because, obviously it's 90s hip hop, and, you know, Rick Famuyiwa had all the songs picked out, and Pharrell had written some original songs, and they needed a score very quickly, and Hans and Steve Kofsky were very kind and gave that to me to do. So that gave me this chance to really delve more into hip hop. And so I thought, oh, wow, this is great. It's so perfect with the rhythm and the programming.
Yeah.
I got to use some of Pharrell's rhythm loops. So it was very short turnaround, like the whole thing delivered in less than a month. So I got a space at Hans's studio and just worked around the clock and worked with Rick, who had a really amazing sound palette already built into the film. But it was a great story. The other thing that was great about it was the message. You know, the message that African Americans, you know, people of color, like they can be the smartest people. They can work so hard, but yet some people in our society cannot view them as anything and who they truly are.
Yeah.
And the challenges that gives, and how young students today have to deal with that. And it was a real good coming of age story. And I loved helping with that music and, you know, being able to work on that.
Only a song has the power to change a heart.
Speaking of great messages and meaningful stories, how early did you get involved on Coco?
I got involved in 2013. It was 4 years before final production. I got asked to do some arrangements. I received that work through my agent, Laura Engel, and she, you know, was pitching my work. And so they were like, well, maybe we can use her to do some arrangements. And so I got asked to do some of the initial arrangements for Remember Me. And they basically said, we want you to turn it into this huge, you know, Mexico meets Hollywood production number, which was such a fun assignment for me.
Yeah.
Remember me, though I have to say goodbye, remember me. Don't let it make you cry.
And so I worked with, you know, many musicians here. I programmed things. I'd go back and forth demos. And so I started with that song, and I had some success with it, and they liked it. And, you know, we made changes over a couple of years. I mean, they'd call me, and then I wouldn't hear for several months, and then they'd give me another assignment. I was working with Lee Unkrich and Darla K. Anderson and Adrian Molina, and it was great because I felt like, this is the perfect assignment for me. I love film music. I love Mexican music. And I want people to know what a incredible, you know, world of music that Mexican music is. And it's not just mariachi music. So then they asked me to do the logo. wound up doing a trailer for him for D23, and you know, just little by little. And then one day they called and said, would you write some songs? And I said, absolutely, thank you.
Say that I'm crazy or call me a fool. But last night it seemed that I dreamed about you.
It seems like this is a project that was just tailor-made for you and your talents and your background. Was it ever considered that you would score it as well?
Of course, I would have loved to have that opportunity, but I was, I didn't think that was going to be a possibility. You know, I was not asked to do that, but I was asked to score, you know, a trailer. And then in the final ending story, Proud Corazon, part of that is score, and then it turns into song.
To a melody played on the strings of our souls, and a rhythm that rattled us down to the bone. Our love for each other will live on forever. In every beat of my proud corazon, our love for each other.
Happy to be working on the project, and then I got to work with Michael, orchestrate half the score with his assistant Jeff Krika. He was a really great person to work with because he would ask me when I was helping him in the booth at the sessions, and I would listen and say, I think we need to put trumpet on this and add this here, and he would say, okay, great, let's do it, you know. So that was wonderful. And then he got backing up, he got Rogue One because he was going to go to Mexico and produce all the musicians there. And then he got Rogue One, and they asked me to go to Mexico, and I had 10 days to prepare for a whole lot of music. And it was an experience of a lifetime working with the musicians in Mexico.
What color is the sky? Ay, mi amor. Ay, mi amor. You tell me that it's red. Ay, mi amor. Ay, mi amor. Where should I put my shoes? Ay, mi amor. Ay, mi amor. You say, put them on your head. Ay, mi amor. Ay, mi amor.
Did Coco and its success and people hearing your music, did that directly lead to anything?
Absolutely. I mean, I was really happy that I was invited, you know, to go to the premiere and to go to different press events, and they encouraged me and had me, you know, part of all the discussion as part of the music team. At the beginning, I felt like I really wasn't sure what my role was, but at the end, I was considered part of the music team, and I loved that. I loved having that opportunity, and I really did feel like it changed my perspective of myself because I'd always been in the background, you know. And that was a personal choice, you know.
Yeah.
But it was a nice thing for me to realize that, you know, each person has something to contribute through their music. And I had this long thread with my culture and my family and my heritage. And had I not, you know, grown up listening to all that Mexican music, being in the orchestra in El Paso, traveling to Mexico, I don't think I could have sat in the studio with those musicians with no translator and just really, it was a transformation for me because I saw that there was a lineage between the musicians there and the music of Mexico and then my family, and we were able to communicate, and sometimes we just sat in the room and played, and I would just bask in that amazing experience. And so that did change me, and it opened up doors, which one of them, I think, was Tag, the next film that I did after Coco.
It couldn't be much more different from Coco, which mm-hmm. is good. You're not getting pigeonholed.
I like that, too. No, it's a great film. I had so much fun doing that.
How did you look at the challenge of enhancing the comedy or supporting the comedy, uh-huh. not getting in the way, or what was your approach to serving the film?
Well, absolutely, comedy, you have to stay away from giving the joke musically before it arrives with the narrative and the actors acting. So I had to tread lightly and more delicately in certain scenes because they were all very stylized. Jeff has a very interesting approach to the film. He doesn't want the music to be traditional comedy with a bongo and a triangle and that jazz mm-hmm. kind of feel. He wanted it to be something that was driven by their incredible desire to win the game and how far they would go to win. So he wanted this theme to be like a caper theme and to be on a mission. And, you know, so some of the cues are big action cues and all they're doing is trying to tag each other. That was a challenge to find how would a theme that would work as a caper theme work later on? Would it transform into something else? And we were always talking about how that should be the friendship thing because that's what this whole film is about. You know, I worked with him on the caper theme and then eventually we did an additional theme for like a mission theme because they were always on a mission. And that was the kind of over the top, bold, big brass, lots of low brass, you know, superhero kind of action thing.
You were scoring the stakes that they imagined in their head, basically.
Exactly. And you hear that in those scenes where they're talking internally, trying to catch the other person, and it's very stylized.
I don't want to always dwell, when I interview women in this field, I don't want to make them the spokesperson for half the planet's population, and and it often goes there. Unfortunately, though, the numbers are so depressing. The percentage, Tag is probably one of the only films coming out this summer that was scored by a woman. And it's one of the few films this whole year that was scored by a woman that's, you know, going to be playing in theaters across the country. What is your fundamental sort of diagnosis of why the numbers are so depressing? And what do you think is one practical way of a solution?
Fundamental diagnosis. Well, I think part of the problem is that women aren't seeing themselves in these positions. And so, as you said, you know, how does a woman not become selfless and become selfish and change the way she's been raised? So it takes a whole, you know, paradigm shift in terms of the person doing it. But it's not just that, it's the system, because a lot of people want to hire women, but they can't, because they don't have the backing of the, you know, corporate heads, the studio heads. And even though there is a lot more talk about it, when we see the numbers go up, then we'll know that change has actually happened.
Yeah.
So it's not just individually women needing to change the way they approach their, you know, work habits, their career. It's having the studios embrace the fact that these voices that are not being heard are valuable and capable and professional. I have had a studio head say to me, a VP of music of a studio, I won't mention which name, he said, I would love to hire you, but I can't. Meaning he would not be allowed to. So when those kind of things change and people don't think it's an anomaly that a woman has done this, or let's not even discuss women of color, or, you know, that could be what, 0.05%? Yeah. I haven't done the numbers. And not just women, you know, people of color, just, you know, a spectrum of people who have ideas. And I don't have a solution, but one thing that I personally do is I do things like this. I speak at universities. I speak at elementary schools. I've had 10-year-old children write to me and say, I want to be a composer because you came to my class and talked about Coco. So, you know, when young women and men see people doing it, they think, oh, I can. And so that and the education, I mean, it takes a whole lot of education to get to this point. And to have the lessons, to have the classical training, to have the writing, the technology, it's a lot of effort. So when somebody feels that they can't do it, they might take a different path. Because a lot of women try this path and then they leave this field because they have families to raise and children. And so they might do other things because they couldn't get in. And they just, I have friends who have left the field because they didn't have success.
Well, I think it's powerful to go to see a movie and look up on the screen and then see music by and then a woman's name. I think that alone is such a powerful thing to show girls in the audience that it's done and it can be done. So bravo to you, and I'm so glad to see all the success that you're having.
Well, thank you. And I, you know, it's people like you that who support composers and artists that talk about our work and give us the platform to discuss the issues and the music, because it's really all about music for me and a lot of other composers. And they want to have that opportunity. So when we get the chance to show people that we can do it, then I think that's part of opening that door. And I always say you get there by one door at a time, and people shouldn't expect that it's going to happen overnight, no matter what artist it is. I have to thank the people who gave me that opportunity, because and who have supported me, like the Sundance Institute and the Academy and just Women in Film, Women in Music. All these groups are really trying to uplift women in the industry.
Yeah.
And I think collectively and ASCAP, we're going to get there. We just have to move faster, I think.
But one door at a time.
Exactly.
Señoras y señores, buenas tardes, buenas noches. Buenas tardes, buenas noches, señoritas y señores. To be here with you tonight brings me joy, que alegría. For this music is my language and the world is mi familia.
Tag is in theaters now, and you can find the score, along with the soundtrack for Coco and other Franco scores like Margarita and Shovel Buddies, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you get your music. And if you're in Southern California, you can hear new music by Germaine Franco, performed at the upcoming Future is Female concert, September 4th at the Wiltern. The concert will also feature new music by Ronit Kirchman, Cindy O'Connor, Heather McIntosh, and an upcoming guest on this podcast, Mudbound composer Tamar Colley. That's it for this episode of Music for Moving Pictures. I'm still Tim Grieving. Join me again next time as we continue listening to the movies.